Is corporate ethics an oxymoron? Do you have to be a jerk to be a successful CEO? Is exploitation the only path to profit? The good news is that many companies, big and small, in the food economy are blazing a different path through Wall Street's jungle of greed, demonstrating that money and morality can be compatible. Texas supermarket chain HEB, for example, has drawn an intense loyal customer base by 1. Investing in good wages and benefits for employees, 2. Showing up in such emergencies as pandemics, hurricanes, freezes to give essential supplies and hands-on help, and 3. Being an involved and supportive neighbor to the hundreds of unique communities it serves. Also, Maine Grains is relocalizing the business of milling grain by working with local farmers who had been abandoned by global grain marketers. They're producing flours from heritage grains, boosting the local economy in the process. Then, there's Bob's Red Mill, which also mills its products from diverse natural grains, and it's 100% employee-owned. These are part of a rising business alternative to the selfish profiteering ethic of Fortune 500 titans. Called certified B corporations, they definitely exist to make a profit, but they're equally focused on having a positive social impact, prioritizing fair wages, environmental protections, and healthy communities as core elements of their missions, even making those goals legal requirements of their corporate charter. This is Jim Hightower saying Ben & Jerry's and New Belgium Brewery are just a couple more of some 3,800 other businesses now organized as B Corps. Though not pretending to be perfect, they're at least striving to be more than money grubbers, instead trying to contribute to the common good. For more information, go to bcorporation.net. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you lowdowners who subscribe to our monthly newsletter, The Hightower Lowdown. You know who you are. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we're heading for some interesting waters as the 27th is coming around. And look, you've got Kyrsten Sinema. That's how I always screw her name up. You got her saying if we don't get the bipartisan bill, the other one is dead in the water. We're getting nothing. You got Joe Manchin who's saying, well, let's take a little pause, maybe till next year. You got folks on the progressive side saying, well, we don't get one, you're not getting the other. We're in really an interesting time right now. And here to share some thoughts on maybe how to figure this all out and move us in a more positive direction. I've asked our good friend Bill Scheer to come talk with us. Bill's a contributing editor over at Politico Magazine. You can check out his work over at BillScheerMedia.com. Bill, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to be here. I don't know if I'm going to deliver on the positivity, but I'm going to try.
No, see, I got to tell you, I'm someone who believes we're getting nothing. So I start from a position of probably going to get nothing. Or the other scenario is Republicans come to the rescue in the House just to send a wedge between the Democrats come 2022.
Well, you know, I certainly thought that Republicans might do that, and they still might. I actually wrote an article in Real Clear Politics on Monday making the case why they should, for their own interest. If they think they're going to produce Democrats in disarray by voting no, I think at minimum they run the risk of doing the opposite. That right. could push the progressives and moderates together, because if the moderates say, oh, hey, Republicans, you're going to move the goalposts? You're going to take a bipartisan bill and you're going to tank it? Then what trust can I have in you? You leave me no choice, but I just do what I can with the progressives. Whereas, you know, what the Republicans have been saying is, we don't want the bills linked. We don't want the infrastructure bill linked to the bigger reconciliation bill, which is understandable on their part. They don't want their conservative constituents to think they aided this enormous progressive bill. So they have reason to want these things separated. Well, if Republicans vote with AOC and vote with the squad, that is voting to link the bills. That's not voting to de-link the bills. But they might operate rationally.
Right. You know,
they might be thinking it this way. And there's no evidence. There's only two Republicans on the record right now saying they would vote for it. And they're going to need a lot more than that if they're actually going to offset having their progressives withhold from the bill.
Right.
So as of today, you certainly can't be optimistic that the infrastructure bill is going to pass. And you have moderates saying, well, the infrastructure, if that doesn't pass, then we're not going to vote for reconciliation. If that's where we are, I'm not saying that is where we're going to land, but just on its face, it would mean nobody gets anything.
Right. And this is where I started from the beginning. And all of my progressive friends were saying, no, Rick, you're wrong. We're going to get both bills. And I'm like, I keep saying we're getting nothing at the end of this road other than headache and heartache. And sadly, you know, trouble come next election season simply because of where we are politically and that we can't seem to get things over the goal line on the Democratic side. Now, today you tweeted out basically a quote of Kirsten Sinema. You said Sinema to Joe Biden, if the House delays its scheduled September 27th vote on the bipartisan infrastructure plan, or if the vote fails, she won't be backing a reconciliation bill. Basically that, and you got AOC to quote tweet you saying, look, you know, you can't change the terms of the deal. The deal was they would be linked together if we had this September 27th deadline, right?
Well, I don't understand. Well, there's two things I don't understand. Number one is AOC is saying you can't change the terms of the deal. There never was a deal between progressives and moderates in terms of the sequencing of these two bills. Pelosi said early in the summer that she was not going to move the bipartisan infrastructure bill until reconciliation got through the Senate. Although now Pelosi has modified that. That's like a two-column shot. I think Pelosi has moved off that position, but let's just get back to where we were in the summer. Pelosi made that marker. Biden said these go in tandem. Then Biden walked away from that under moderate pressure. You never heard the moderates say, we agree, Nancy Pelosi. These things go in tandem. They've always said that the infrastructure bill, the bipartisan bill, should be treated on its own merits and reconciliation on its own merits. There's no deal there. Now, progressives, to be fair to them, when the bipartisan deal was done, they immediately said, well, we didn't sign on to that. We didn't say we're going to vote for that on its own. You know, so no one's being dishonest as far as their own position is concerned, but there's no changing or undoing of a deal that did never existed.
Right.
So that I think AOC is not being fair in that regard on that. Number two, you don't, as angry as progressives surely are with Sinema, at the end of the day, they need Sinema's vote. They can't get reconciliation without Sinema's vote. And so, you know, what's the best way to get her vote? Is it to browbeat her and shame her in public? Or is it to talk with her privately and work out a deal? I would think the latter myself. But of course, I could certainly, maybe they can bear all sorts of grassroots pressure on her and make her crack. I just feel like looking at the past 7 months, there's been a lot of progressive ire directed towards Sinema, and I haven't seen her crack. So I wouldn't think that's the way to approach her. But that's not the way AOC is going about it.
Yeah, no, but I'm of the mindset some carrots, some sticks. You got to do a little bit of both. Keep moving in that direction. Little fear back home helps. Move in the right direction. But also, you know, in the old days, you would just go, "What do you want? What bridge in Arizona do you need? You know, what program is it?" Because you know, I'm looking at both her and Manchin and going, you know, especially Manchin from West Virginia, one of the poorest states in the country. What do you need? What is it you want to? What bacon do you want to bring home? Because we got to get this across the line. Because next year, come election cycle, if you don't get this bigger infrastructure bill, this human infrastructure bill, you are going to get slaughtered at the ballot box.
Well, that's why what you just said at the end there is why I've generally been optimistic that something will pass. It doesn't really serve any Democrats' interest to, you know, to ruin Biden's presidency. If Biden is at 40% because he is seen as impotent in his position and cannot deliver anything for the public, well, that takes down every vulnerable Democrat come 2022. So there's collective interest in doing something, but there is not consensus on what that something is right now. To the other point, what do they want? What's very difficult, there's levels of difficulty here. Number one, Manchin and Sinema are not plain spoken people. When you see Manchin on TV, it's a lot of word salad. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Particularly if you actually know what's going on, it really makes no sense at all. So you really can't decipher what is his bottom line. And Sinema doesn't talk much at all. So there's a lot under the surface that we don't know what their bottom line really is. But also keep in mind, they're not the only two moderates in this picture. There's other Senate moderates who also don't talk a lot. There are different pockets of House moderates, and they're not all working collectively. They don't have like a set 5 points they're all pushing for. They all have their little provincial agendas. And this is, I would say, the biggest single piece of legislation ever attempted in American history. There are so many moving parts to this. It's a very hard thing to do.
And
it would be hard to do in any circumstance. This is also one of the narrowest majorities in American history, where any few number of people can thwart your majority. So it's a real high wire act that Democrats are trying to accomplish here. And hey, bully for them if they can pull it off. But it shouldn't be surprising that it's hitting resistance at the front end of this process, and then it's going to take some time to work it all out. And there is risk of it not working out.
No, it's something we need desperately. And I've been saying, look, if you can get the $1.5 trillion that Manchin said that, you know, he might be willing to go up to, I say you grab it and you run. You get it put into law, you get it somewhat funded, and then you fight next year to go, hey, we got it, we need to fully fund it, but you got to get it first.
Well, that funding piece is so critical and complicated. I mean, you know, just with the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which was a smaller bill, figuring out the pay-fors was the hardest part of that negotiation. And they weren't even trying to do progressive things with it. They were trying to essentially avoiding progressive things, avoiding progressive taxation, avoiding taxation of the wealthy and corporations. Now Democrats want to do a big progressive reform. And not every individual Democrat is on board for every individual piece. Anytime you change the tax code, there are winners and losers.
Right.
And those winners and losers are not evenly distributed across the country. So, you know, one guy in one district, his constituency is hit hard there. It might even be a majority of his constituents or her constituents. It might just be a faction. But that faction might be the difference between that person winning or losing in the next election. So they have to be sensitive to that. So there's that, you know, complicated aspect of it. And the less you can do on the funding front, the less you can pay for, all those parts are so hard to line up. Another budgetary trick here that is also complicated about what do you want to fund. The moderates are generally saying, let's fund things for longer periods of time. Let's not do short-term extensions. And progressives are more inclined to do things short-term because if you could do more things within your top line. I mean, right now, this cannot be bigger than $3.5 trillion under the terms of the budget resolution that previously passed. They can't go higher.
Right.
So if that's your ceiling and you want to do child tax credit, enhanced ACA subsidies, Medicare, dental, vision, hearing, universal pre-K, community college, elder care, climate, you want to do all those things within that under that ceiling, well, I'll do this one for 1 year, this one for 2 years, this one for 3 years, because on its own, it doesn't cost as much. And you might be saying, wink, wink, we'll extend it later, but it won't blow the cap of this bill. The moderates are saying, we see that gimmick a mile away. You're not really being honest about the cost. We'll do child tax credit for 4 or 5 years. We'll do ACA subsidies for 4 or 5 years. But then that's eating up a larger chunk of the pie, and maybe you can't do dental, vision, hearing then, for example. So that's one of the many points of friction that is happening right now, and that's why this is not getting done, you know, in a few weeks' time.
Yeah, I started from the beginning, and, you know, I've got friends who were in Congress at the time, and how we used to do budgets in the old days is you had 13 budget resolutions that would come through the House for different for different things. I'm of the mindset, why can't we use those 13 budget resolutions and bring those through reconciliation one by one and cut this giant bill down into much smaller ones that would be easier to sell and more digestible?
Well, just to be technical, normally you 13 appropriations bills.
Right.
That an appropriation bill generally covers the next fiscal year. It's, they're not designed to be the next 10 years. And that's just sort of your basic, you keep the government running, you know, tweak here, tweak there. Democrats right now presume, or at least recognize the good chance, they won't have control of Congress in 2023. That this is their shot. This is their shot to do the big stuff, to get that embedded in the social fabric. And so by 2024, I mean, even if it doesn't pay off in 2022, maybe by 2024 it will pay off, and they will be rewarded by the public for that. And you know, there is no one lowering expectations about what can be done. So everyone's trying to get on this train. This is the train leaving the station. Get your thing in this bill, because there will be no other bill. Yeah. So that's an understandable impulse, but it sure makes the legislative process really, really complicated.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. And I'm still the ever-lover pessimist in this, and I fear nothing happens. If you were a betting man, if you were putting money down, how do you see it playing out?
Well, I can't really bet on infrastructure passing on Monday, what I've read in the paper today. I mean, maybe things change between now and then, but you have no reason to be optimistic based on what information that we currently have. And boy, after that, once, because Requesus will say, aha, we took the hostage and we won. Now we have better leverage for reconciliation. Moderates, if you want anything, you gotta do things our way. And then moderates are saying, well, we're just gonna tank the whole thing. And now you're back in a stalemate. At some point, they got to get in a room together and work it out. There has to be trust. There's no trust right now. To do what you're talking about before, one bill at a time, if there was trust, that's what you would do. You would pass infrastructure now, and knowing you'll get to reconciliation short enough, or you would do six or seven bills one at a time because you're confident the next steps would come. Right now, the progressives don't trust the moderates will come along. They think if they give them one thing now, they won't get the second thing, let alone the third, fourth, third, seventh.
And I completely agree. You pass that bipartisan bill, you're getting nothing on the bigger bill. At least that's my view. You're getting nothing.
I mean, that's the fear. I don't know if that is true, but clearly that's what's driving the progressive thinking right now. And until there is trust, we're not going to move forward.
Well, last question I wanted to ask you about, because today the news came out of this 6-point memo. I don't know if you happen to see the Trump lawyer memo of the 6-point plan to overturn the election. Any thoughts about the story today?
I haven't seen the memo. But it's just one more data point of what I think we all know, that they really went, you know, to the mat trying to overturn the election. I think the optimistic view about this, we had a sitting president of the United States do everything he possibly could to overturn the election and could not do it. The Constitution is stronger than that. It is not so simple to steal an election. You need to have one hell of a conspiracy. You need to have a whole lot of people lined up at every level of government, state legislatures, judges, state judges, federal judges. Everyone's got to be in on the scam if you're going to pull it off. And these Keystone cops are not able to pull it off. I know people will say, well, if you had different people in different places, maybe they would have pulled it off. And I can't definitively argue otherwise, but I do think it is very, very hard to steal an American presidential election in broad daylight. And they tried it.
They tried. They failed. But again, it comes back to, you know, had it not been for Mike Pence, you know, maybe it's a whole different outlet. Had he done what Trump wanted, had he done what the crowd on January 6th was ready to hang him over not doing, we could be in a different place.
Hey, give the props to my man Dan Quayle.
Yep,
who told Mike Pence, you know, the authority. You, for those of you on the radio who can't see this, I am wearing my Dan Quayle Center and Museum shirt, which I think is only one in existence, because I visited the Dan Quayle Vice Presidential Museum and Center in Huntington, Indiana. And I wear the shirt proudly today as one of the people who saved the Constitution, saved the Republic.
I now got to go to the Dan Quayle Vice Presidential Library now. I got to do it. All because of you, Bill. Bill, I appreciate the time. Hope folks will check out your work over at BillShareMedia.com. He does work over at Politico Magazine and Real Clear Politics. Bill, always great talking with you, my friend.
You too. Take care.
Good stuff, Bill Shear. Make sure you check out his work. Quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1912. That was the day that labor activist Mother Jones led a march of miners' children through the streets of Charleston, West Virginia. Her aim was to illustrate the effects of poverty. In the speech she gave that day, Mother Jones declared, "Tyranny, robbery, and oppression of the people must go. The children must be educated." Her march took place during the 1912 to 1913 Paint Creek, Cabin Creek coal miners' strike in that state. During the strike, gunfire was exchanged between members of the United Mine Workers and the mine owners' hired private army. The governor declared martial law on three separate occasions. Mother Jones was arrested in February of 1913. She was accused of conspiring to commit murder and brought before a military court. She refused to recognize the legitimacy of her court-martial. Mother Jones was sentenced to 20 years in the state penitentiary. While she was under house arrest for 85 days, Mother Jones contracted a dangerous case of pneumonia. She was 76 years old. Her support of the miners and subsequent trial helped build the reputation of Mother Jones as a tough union activist and the miners' angel. It also helped lead the U.S. Senate to launch an investigation into conditions in the West Virginia coal mines. When Henry D. Hatfield was elected governor of West Virginia, he was determined to end the labor crisis. He released those who had been convicted under the military court. On May 8th, Mother Jones was set free. Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, continued her fight for working people. Mother Jones's trial helped to spotlight the low wages coal miners earned, the long hours they worked, and the dangerous working conditions under which they toiled. One of her most remembered quotes is, "Pray for the dead, but fight like hell for the living."
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You got to love those hot mic moments where you turn the mic off. So for those who wanted the rest of the story, one of the things that we've done here at the program over the years is, you know, we've done a labor history tour in 2013, 2015. We did a civil rights tour. We've done a bunch of traveling with the show to, you know, to talk about, you know, labor's involvement in a bunch of things. And presidential libraries are one of those, you know, kind of cool things that, you know, along the way you get to see. And, you know, during our tours, we've hit a couple of them, and I would like to see all of them, because I think they're, you know, the history of those presidencies and how they decide to present that presidency is really, really incredible to me. Like, you know, one of the things that I remember most about the McKinley Museum in Ohio is there was a labor riot in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And in there was an axe handle with this, you know, with like an axe, like a homemade axe that they made that they were handing out to the thugs to turn down the striking workers. And it was one of those, just, you know, one of those amazing things that you look at and you go, the answer to a labor strike back during the McKinley presidency was, you know, to hand people axes to put workers down. I mean, it was a weird kind of thing. But, you know, I look at it and, you know, it keeps the history of those administrations alive. Now, you know, obviously, McKinley's isn't going to be as expansive as George W.'s was. I still want to get to H.W.'s library in College Station, Texas. There's a bunch of these out there. And the W one was the most bizarre for me, because it was, I guess it was, you know, the closest to, you know, this is, I lived through this nightmare. And you walk into the place and it's, you know, it's 9/11, you know, just all over the place. You know, big, giant twisting metal kind of things all over the place, and then a wall, like a bank of video screens with every image of the planes hitting the towers. And it was just one of those things that, you know, you start off with, you know, wow, this is just crazy. And, you know, in there is a bookshelf, like a kid's bookshelf, with, you know, the whole bunch of kids' books. And I remember just thinking, you know, the difference in the tragedy and the hope for education that he was trying to pitch that he had. Just interesting. There were a couple little weird, quirky things, though. Like, there was a, because it's probably the most interactive, you know, because, I guess they think kids are going to come and play. But they had this triangle on a little ball. And the argument was, you know, the balance of powers. Each corner of the triangle was, you know, obviously the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. And you're supposed to try and balance this on the ball. And you saw people, you know, sitting there for, you know, hours trying to figure, and you're never going to do it. It's never going to happen. And I think that was the point of it, is that you're never going to get a perfect balance. I think if you have to read into it, I think that's what it was. But, you know, I found the museum to be, you know, high, you know, lots of graphics, lots of, you know, interactive stuff. But my favorite was the decider guy part, where you went into this room and for like 2 or 3 minutes, they just inundate you with stimulus. You know, you get a, you know, news clip, you know, stock market's crashing. This, a senator is coming in. Sorry, Senator, our constituents are, you know, complaining that the stock market's crashing. And your chief of staff's running in. Oh, my God, this guy's falling. You get somebody else. Oh, your kids are on fire. You get all this just hammered with stuff, constant. And then after this bombardment, you now have to decide. And it was all the crisis that, you know, it was 9/11. It was the stock market crash. It was all the things that he had to make decisions on. And, you know, you're supposed to then decide. And if the room decides that he was right, he comes out and says, yeah, hey, you were with me. Congratulations. We made the same decisions. And he gives a little explanation. Every time I did it, this is the weird thing. Every time I did it, and I went through it 4 different times. Every time I did the little you decider guy thing, everybody in the room decided against him. They went with the other idea. And then he trots out, you know, virtually, of course. I think he's got painting or something to do. But virtually he trots out and he explains why he did what he did. A little rewrite of history, found very interesting. But it was one of those interactive things. It was, you know, kind of cool. For me, 2 things also stood out. Evidently, he stole the Situation Room. Because on 9/11, they realized that they really were antiquated in their ability to communicate. So they basically, you know, redid the entire Situation Room, upgrading to the technology of the day. And then they stole everything, the walls, the tables, everything, and put it in the conference center there, which we got to do some interviews in, which was really kind of cool. We got to sit in the Situation Room where they were talking about what happened on 9/11 and how to respond. Kind of cool. The other thing, and the most, you know, grotesque part of it for me, was when you walk into the other entrance of the entrance of the entire thing, not the tour, there's a giant granite wall, and on that wall are people's names, like in foot high letters, that are etched into the stone. And you would think that these are the people who, you know, lost their lives in 9/11, soldiers maybe. No. These are the donors who paid for it. And they would not tell me how much it cost to get their name etched in granite for all of eternity to be in that library. Cost $1,000 to sign the digital registry, which I guess goes away after a couple of years. But to get on the wall, no one would tell me how much. And there were a lot of, you know, our captains of industry, our billionaire class that were made wealthier by his tax bills. That was the part that got me. But I'm a big fan of presidential libraries. And that wasn't what I had planned. But since I had the open mic moment, I kind of thought, you know, look, go to the presidential libraries. I thought the Truman one was interesting. The Eisenhower one I thought was really interesting since it was on the site of his childhood home. And you got to go through, you know, Eisenhower's home, where he grew up as a kid. And, you know, they had all this display, and it's really kind of cool to go back and especially during those eras where, you know, I didn't live like that. And you got to see, you know, how things were. I just just well worth doing. Thought it was great. I'd love to hear your thoughts, though. Have you ever been to one of these presidential libraries? I'm looking forward to Clinton's. On a real sick level, and this is, maybe I won't tell you, but I shouldn't say this. On a sick level, I want to see Trump's. I want to see what Trump's presidential, if he does one. I do. I want to see the gold toilets. I want to see, you know, I want to see the gaudy kind of, that gaudy, gold and all of that. I want to see a library, with his name splattered all over everything. Now, again, there'll be no books. Everything will be illustrations and redone with Sharpie. But I'm at a real perverse level. I want to go. I want to go. Anyway, I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
You get too close to a point of no return. We don't have a lot of time. So we have to act. All of us, we have to act now.
Humanity on a catastrophic pathway, new UN report finds. Good news and bad for climate action at the UN General Assembly, plus...
Fire is not going to go away. It's going to keep burning.
Good news and bad for the world's last stand of giant sequoias.
All of that good news... and bad, straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We're all tenants of planet Earth. We are definitely not getting our security deposit back.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I think I'm starting to see why people are annoyed with the United Nations. They keep putting out these reports, and they aren't good news.
No, they are not. First, the bad news. Despite new updated pledges to cut global greenhouse gas emissions under the United Nations Paris Climate Agreement, a new UN report projects the world is poised to rise a catastrophic 2.7 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Oy. Without major action. Oy. That is far above the 2 degrees Celsius target that countries had agreed to. Now, this new report says that's if all of the countries meet their emissions promises that they've made so far. And under current commitments, global emissions are likely to increase by 16% by 2030. Scientists warn governments need to slash global emissions by 45% by 2030 to be on the path to reach carbon neutrality by 2050. Humanity's use of fossil fuels has already heated the planet more than 1 degree Celsius, and we're already seeing its effects in increasingly frequent extreme heat waves, droughts, fires, floods, and rising sea levels. What would a world with 2.7 degrees Celsius of warming look like? Well, here's climate scientist Dr. Michael Mann.
We don't want to find out, and that's why it's so important that, we not kick the can down the road several decades. We need to make sure that we decarbonize our economy now.
Yes, we do. Again, that report from the UN is based on current pledges from countries around the world. And even with those pledges, it is not going to be enough.
The new UN report was released in conjunction with the annual meeting of world governments at the United Nations General Assembly in New York City. It also finds that wealthy nations have fallen more than $20 billion short of the $100 billion in climate aid that they promised to poorer countries that did not cause man-made climate change. And that has deepened mistrust between nations. As UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson explained at the UN,
it is the developing world that is bearing the brunt of catastrophic climate change in the form of hurricanes and fires and floods and the real long-term economic damage that they face. And yet it's the developed world that over 200 years has put the carbon in the atmosphere that is causing this acceleration of climate change. And so it really is up to us to help them.
Way to go, wealthy and developed countries. Use up all the resources and pull the ladder up after you.
And it matters because climate change is already fueling a wave of migration. A new World Bank report finds that migration is on the rise within countries in East and Central Asia, North Africa, and Eastern Europe due to climate change affecting crop yields and water availability. The researchers project that absent concerted climate and development action, more than 200 million people could be forced to migrate to escape climate change impacts within the next 30 years.
Yeah, good luck. Where are they going to go?
But President Biden, late last week, formally unveiled a new agreement with the European Union to cut global methane emissions by at least 30% by 2030. That could be big because methane, the primary ingredient in natural gas, is a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide on shorter timescales. And scientists say cutting methane pollution is the single fastest, most effective strategy we have to slow the rate of warming. Finally, in California, the bad news is that the state's relentless wildfire season is second only to last year's record-setting wildfire season. Worse, the extent of this year's fires is already bigger than where we were this time last year. But the good news, in California's Sequoia National Park, thanks to aggressive firefighting and decades of intense forest management, fire crews so far have been able to defend the ancient giant trees from the massive KNP complex wildfire. And according to Sequoia National Park's chief scientist, Dr. Christy Brigham, on a recent broadcast, there is a lot that the public can do to help save this forest for future generations.
Climate change, that is at the root of this problem, and we can all take part in that solution individually and collectively.
Well, we can try. Of course, what's it say about the situation we're in where the good news is when a 3,000-year-old forest isn't burning down that bad so far. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So one of the things I've been talking about here recently is there have been some forces out there trying to pitch us this idea that maybe a return to the good old days, a return to the company town, might not be a bad thing. Maybe, you know, a company like Amazon with Bezos and the need for these big complexes, maybe if they had, you know, reasonable houses right there, you know, maybe if you got workers some reasonable cost housing, you know, right there, transportation, build these little utopian worker communities, it would be great. I got to tell you, I look back to the past where we had those kind of things, and it did not end well for working people. Not at all. And here to share some thoughts on this resurgent idea of are we better now? Are we smarter? Can we have company towns again? I've asked our good friend John Shelton to come back and share some thoughts with us. John is a professor at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, it's so great to be here. Hi, Rick.
So I'm in this spot, John, where I'm looking at these stories and I'm seeing a couple of them starting to sprout up. This idea, you know, hey, this company town idea might not be a bad idea. We could surround the factory with, you know, reasonably cost housing that the employees can have. Sounds almost utopian.
Yeah, you know, so I'm guessing the big piece that's been kind of making the rounds is that piece in Bloomberg, you know, which was sort of arguing, you know, can these sort of Amazon company towns lead to a more sustainable set of jobs for working class people? And, you know, it ignores a lot of things, right? I mean, so on the one hand, as you said, it ignores the history of company towns in this country. And, you know, there's an interesting parallel because I don't think it's a surprise that we're talking about this at a moment when workers really have, you know, at least for the past few decades, a historic amount of leverage. The labor market's tight. There's a so-called, you know, job shortage, worker shortage, which effectively means that workers just have a choice in where they can go and can actually drive up wages. And, you know, that was a lot of these company towns You know, there's probably a lot of examples that your listeners are familiar with. I mean, this was sort of a strategy of Ford. But, you know, you could also look at some somewhat less famous examples like Pullman in Illinois, right, that you know, made the Pullman luxury cars. And in Wisconsin, we've got Kohler, right, which, you know, effectively kind of set up as at least an experiment in a company town in the 1920s. And part of the rationale for that, you know, was about reducing worker turnover and keeping workers, right, by, you know, effectively kind of creating something of a captive audience, because workers have to be there. It's a pain in the ass to move, or maybe they can't afford to move. And it strikes me that that's a big part of this conversation now, is like trying to find, you know, arguments, you know, sort of artificial ways to keep workers on the job, you know, rather than being able to, you know, go out and seek other gigs in this, you know, historically good moment for them.
Yeah. The great resignation, we're calling it.
Yeah. So that's number one. But number two, you know, one of the arguments is that, you know, say Amazon, for example, is paying, you know, really good wages for that sector of work. I think, you know, they're offering in some places $17-18 an hour. But, you know, what that really ignores is that, you know, so much of what makes a job good and so much of what makes a job, you know, have dignity is workers having a say. And so it's not just about the wages. So much of this is about, I mean, I know you know this concept and probably a lot of your listeners do too, industrial democracy. The idea that, you know, workers should have a union so they have some say over their, you know, working conditions, so that those workers in Amazon can take breaks, so they can take bathroom breaks, so they can, you know, make sure they're not being physically crushed, as we've heard from so many of those workers what the accounts of working there is like. And so, you know, any kind of sustainable future for workers involves the right to a union. And so with a union busting company like Amazon, you know, this just isn't going to move the needle. And a company town is almost like a funhouse mirror version of, you know, industrial democracy.
No, and one of the things that on the industrial democracy front is ownership. I believe, you know, as having a union and having a voice, you have some ownership of that job, where you're not That's an right. at-will employee. And it's one of those things where, you know, the turnover rates that are going on right now, especially in places like Amazon, I can see how this would be something that they would want. If we can get you into this company housing, we're going to get you, you know, kind of trapped in here a little bit. And the reason I bring that up is, you know, when I first moved to Pennsylvania back in 93, I met a guy who, he told me the story of his family, who, when he got back from Vietnam, they had given him some money when he left the military, and he came back here to central Pennsylvania and paid his family's debt to the company store. And that had been the only time in the history of that family that they were not indebted to that company store. And that story sticks with me, because, you know, that's in my lifetime, that somebody was attached to one of these company stores, to one of these company towns, and in a lifetime of debt. And you go, the history of this, not great. And I don't know why they're, and the Bloomberg piece is the one that's gotten the most attention, but I've seen other people try and make these arguments that, you know, we need benevolent dictators. We have these wealthy people and they're going to take care of us. This movie, this sequel, not going to end any better than the last one.
Yeah. You know, and it's crazy to me, you know, having this conversation, how out of touch these pundits are with, you know, regular America, people who work for a living. So, you know, we were chatting a little bit before this segment about how, you know, my students are back in person this semester. One of my classes is, you know, it's an upper division seminar course called U.S. Labor and the Working Class. And I'm super excited to be doing it. It's the first time I've done it in a couple of years. And we were actually talking about Amazon and company towns today. And my students are working class students. You know, many of them are the first in their generation to go to college. Some of them, like, it's funny because the Kohler example came up almost immediately, because I had a student who had actually worked in the Kohler plant and, you know, was telling us about that history. But when I kind of asked them, you know, what do you know about company towns, or what do you think of when you think about company towns? You know, several students immediately brought up the idea of the company store. That is, you know, something that is seared into popular culture. And it's amazing to me that working people and the sons and daughters of working class families think of that, right? We've got a whole, you know, the famous, I think it was Tennessee Ernie Ford, that has the most famous version of 16 tons, you know, with that famous line about the company store. People know about this, right? And but the fact that you have people at, you know, these journalists at these major media outlets like Bloomberg that are so out of touch with that history and that legacy, and would even write something, you know, making that argument without thinking about that legacy, to me is just mind-boggling. It's so, I understand it, but it's still tough to take.
Is it that they're out of touch, or is it that we're pushing a frame? You know, I look at a lot of what these right-wing think tanks do, the trial balloons they throw, the narratives they spew out. This seemed to me that trial balloon to see what kind of reactions Americans would give to the idea of reviving this horrible idea from the past. And I don't think it got the kind of pushback that it should have.
You know, my internet cut out for a second. What was the first part of what you said?
You know, the first part was because you had said that, you know, the media pundits didn't know or chose. Yeah. I believe that they probably know, but they chose to ignore it. Because like a lot of the right-wing think tanks, they're pushing a narrative and they've got an agenda. And you know, to me, that's what this is, to see what kind of pushback that they would get. And I don't think they've gotten the kind of pushback that it should.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the second part. I'm not sure about the first. I mean, if you think about an outlet like Bloomberg, right, it's one of these, like, you know, I think it would purport to be center left, right? I mean,
but that was an opinion piece. That wasn't an article. That was an opinion piece. And I think, you know, if you don't know it's an opinion piece, then you can make that assumption.
Yes.
But my view, that's an opinion piece. So they're putting their name on that narrative.
Yeah, yeah. No, I get that. But I think what I would say is, you know, you have like a, I don't know, for lack of a better word, like a professional pundit class in this country that is so out of touch that that argument actually makes sense to them. Like, I want to be charitable and actually think like, you know, maybe this is somebody who cares about working class livelihoods and is just so out of touch that they don't know about that history. Yeah. And can't see how wildly ludicrous that argument is.
Yeah, the same people who pitched us the free trade argument during the 90s.
Yeah, exactly. To me, that's where I see this, right? Like, you know, I don't think Clinton, for example, right, negotiating NAFTA, you know, had some kind of nefarious agenda. I think he was just clueless and, you know, and he had these supposedly smart people around him telling him, hey, this is going to help working class livelihoods, when you had all of labor saying, no, it won't. You know, you don't need to have an economics degree to know that this is not going to help our jobs when you can pay somebody much less money, you know, for the same work that doesn't have a union.
Yeah. Now, the thing that gets me is you said that Amazon's paying good wages. You know, as someone who, you know, grew up, you know, in the workforce back in the 80s, you know, a unionized workforce back then was making superior wages to what Amazon is paying.
Yeah.
So my point of reference is, you know, I worked in a warehouse for one of the big hardware chains back in the mid to late 80s, and was making like 10, 11 bucks an hour, which in today's dollars would be like 22, 25 bucks an hour. Mm-hmm. With healthcare, with retirement, with vacation, with all of those things, and job security. So when I think of what a good warehouse job is, that's what I think of. I don't think of Amazon. Now, Amazon, because of this moment, they're having to pay more and they're having to think of outside the box on how they're going to keep people. And it's going to be interesting to see where they go. But I'm not putting them in that good job category yet.
No, 100%. I mean, you're totally right there. And so much of this is about the historical context, right? So, like, you know, I think I just looked at this pretty recently. The numbers of the AFL-CIO, you know, basically the updated numbers are if just the minimum wage stayed where it was in, say, 1968, if it had kept up with worker productivity, right, that you know, wages for workers right now should be about $24-$25 an hour. So, you know, this is connected to the class war from above, right? The efforts of corporations to suppress wages. You know, again, we see this right now in this really hyperventilation about a so-called worker shortage. And what it's really about is not being able to get workers at subpar wages anymore because they have some choices. But yeah, I mean, to say that a $17, $18 an hour job with no union rights, practically speaking, and, you know, this brutal work regime that we know lots of people are working under, where they're afraid to take bathroom breaks. That's not a good job. That's not a job with dignity. But it shows you, you know, that just how far our expectations, and I don't mean you and I, of course, we have high expectations, but that our expectations as a society for what counts as a good job, it shows how far out of whack they are. So I think that's a really good point.
No, and all I have to look at for Amazon is their turnover numbers. That yep. plant in Bessemer, Alabama had an excess uh-huh. of 100% turnover. Yep. I worked for a company for 20 years who they touted the fact that they had a less than 2% turnover rate per year. And they were proud of that. Because they retained good employees, they trained good people, and those employees made them money. I look at the Amazon model where they're just churning through people at an alarming rate in a model that is unsustainable, and at some point they have to do something. So it's my view, I'm looking at this company town thing as the trial balloon of going, how can we trap people? How can mm-hmm. we get them into lease agreements? How can we get them into the housing? How can we hold them back? And this to me seems like that. Now, maybe me just being paranoid, I don't know, but that's what it seems like. And it's just one of those things that it is what it is. But John, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the work that you do. As always, good stuff, my friend. Thanks so much. I hope you come back and talk to us again real soon.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. I'd love that. Have a good night, and have a good night to your listeners.
Thanks so much, John Shelton, professor there at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. As I said, you know, one of the things that's most concerning to me is that they normalize this stuff, and we don't push back hard enough and fast enough. Just my thoughts. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the top.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1991. That was the day that members of the Culinary Workers Union Local 226 went out on strike against the Frontier Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. What they did not know was that the strike would last for more than 6 years, becoming one of the longest work actions in U.S. labor history. The Frontier was the second casino to open on the Vegas Strip in 1942. At the time of the strike, the Ilardi family owned the historic casino. The Ilardis were vehemently anti-union. They renovated the old facility and then reopened, refusing to sign a contract to pay its workers the same rate provided at most other Vegas casinos, claiming that the Frontier was too small to match the wages of the larger outfits. Management refused to budge from their position. In response, Local 226 members mobilized. The year before, Hattie Canty had been elected president of the local. She was a black mother of 10 children and a widow. She had worked as a hotel maid. Her leadership brought a new determination to the Culinary Workers Union. Local 226 set up 24-hour picket lines outside the Frontier. The strike was joined by Bartenders Local 165, Teamsters Local 995, the Operating Engineers Local 501, and the Carpenters Local 1780. The strike became an important moment in Vegas labor history, as other casino owners looked on watching the labor battle unfold. The unions stood strong. The picketers demand that the owners should, quote, sell, shut down, or sign, became the call. In the end, the Ilardis decided to sell. The new ownership signed a union contract and rehired 280 striking workers. Triumphant union members cut a red ribbon at the hotel to mark their victory.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Well, you think about the history of company towns, and it's, you know, we've got a couple here in this area. You go a little bit up north, up 81, and, you know, to Latimer. You go up north into, you know, Scranton, up in that area. They had a bunch of them. And you worked in the mines. You lived in the company town. In fact, up at the Susquehanna, there's a Susquehanna mine up there. Susquehanna Mining Company. They take you down like 300 feet down underground. And they're, you know, they've got a display on how the mining's done and, you know, who does what jobs. And I got to go there, you know, years ago when I was volunteering as a big brother, and they did a big tour. So the bigs and the littles went up there, and I remember going down with my little and him immediately gravitating towards a kid that was exactly his height, because there was a little doll there, and his job was to open and close the fire damp door. And evidently that kid, like six, eight years old, had a 50% fatality rate because they were working like 10, 12 hour days. And, you know, if they weren't paying attention and the door flew open, would just smash them. And I remember the story that the tour guide gave that, you know, if one of the kids got killed or if one of the workers got killed, they would, you know, the boss's job, the foreman's job, was to come down, get the body, throw it up on the coal cart, drag it up to the surface, throw it on the back of a wagon, and drive to the, you know, clip clop over to the house, and literally throw the body at the door of the company owned house, and that was kind of like your eviction notice. And I remember that guy telling this story, going, "That's the history of working in this industry back then." None of these people got paid in cash. They had to go to the company store. They had to go to the company doctor. Everything they did was controlled and costed out by the company. And when things were going bad for the company, they raised the rents so that you had less scrip to spend in other places and so that you would go deeper in debt. I mean, that was the goal all along. The goal was to keep you there, deep, deep in debt. You needed tools, you had to go into debt. You needed medical care for the kids, deeper in debt. You needed food, you needed, something, housing, whatever. It was about keeping you tied to those jobs so that they could keep exploiting you. And for me, and maybe it's just, having spent so much time reading and learning that history, that I look at this, that I view as a trial balloon to see what kind of response American workers will go. Because look, it sounds like a great job. It sounds like a great deal. What? I can be in the neighborhood. I can have transit that will take me back and forth to work. They'll set up a little clinic that I can go to. They're going to have a little store there for me. It's going to sound great. It's utopia. It's a worker's paradise. And the company's going to do all this for us? Oh, that's so wonderful. Oh, they're so benevolent. Until they get you deep into hock. And now you gotta show up every day. And you gotta be there. And you can't demand better wages, hours, conditions. You can't fight for better wages, hours, conditions. You can't do any of that because you're desperate. Because you gotta pay them back. So for me, I look at this as in one of those moments where you go, yeah, what that old, if it sounds too good to be true, probably is. Sounds too good to be true to me. Because you never quite... It reminds me of the truck driver I met years ago who was just thrilled by the fact that in 7 years he was going to own his truck. He was leasing it now for the company, making less than half of the mileage rate that I was making. But in 7 years, that truck was going to be his. And when I told him that in 7 years, it's going to be basically worthless because you will have run it, over 1,000,000 miles and it's going to have to be redone. And it's basically going to be junk and you're going to be stuck with it, kind of crushed his dreams because he didn't think of it that way. He thought it was always going to run perfectly and always going to, he was going to then make the big bucks. It was that moment that he realized, uh-oh, I think I've been screwed. And I see this in the exact same way. It's look, they're not going to do something that benefits you or me ever. It's all about them. Remember that. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Remember, follow us on social media @RickSmithShow. Like us over at Facebook. Subscribe over on YouTube. Lots of ways to interact. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@RickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.